It's really great. Jack Silverstein's in studio. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin.
Jack, of course, the unofficial statistician for the download, and also, I would say, our NBA, our Bulls historian on the program. He's also the author of How the GOAT Was Built. Great, great book about the 96 team, the Chicago Bulls team that was the greatest of all time, although our guest here may disagree.
and has quite a perspective and a right to disagree.
Well, we've got him for the whole hour, so maybe we'll ask. My next guest is a champion. There aren't too many people in Chicago that wouldn't recognize Craig Hodges on the street, good old number 14. Not only played a pivotal role in the Bulls' first championship run, but he also brought us a sense of civic pride when he would win the three-point contest at the All-Star Game over and over, years after year.
year after year.
Craig Hodges is also known as a politically outspoken athlete, one who famously wore his all-white African dashiki to the White House. And was it politics that ended Hodges' career? Whether it was being outspoken about race or trying to convince Michael Jordan to be more conscious about the struggles of the black community, Hodges makes a strong case for being blacklisted by the NBA. The Chicago Heights product just put out his memoir called Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter, and he is in studio tonight. Mr. Hodges, great to see you. Great to meet you.
Appreciate you, man. Thanks for the invite.
All right, so Jack and I, you know, well, Jack knows a lot more about the Bulls than I do, but I was... I didn't know that you grew up in the area. I mean,
yes, with the NBA,
especially with you know, people who come through, they're not always here. But Chicago Heights, right. Talk about Chicago Heights and growing up in the Chicago, right outside of Chicago, between here and Indiana.
Yeah. For me, it was, you know, it was a blessing, man, especially when I think in terms of my development and growth as a student athlete. My granddad was a mentor for a lot of young men in the South Suburbs and as far as sports and the like. And growing up in a household where academics, you know, was paramount, and that the only way you would get to play was to make sure that you was academically correct. So from an early age, I loved to read and write. And as I grew older, I understood how much impact sport could play in my life. And I took it serious, but I still had fun. And I still, to this day, consider, you know, my upbringing. And I thank my grandpops who's passed away, and I just thank my family and those who've had an impact on my life from that standpoint. And Chicago Heights was a great place to grow up, man. I wouldn't change it for the world. At that point when we were growing up, you know, we had programs, so there were summer things to do, where today there's a lot more distractions than what we had growing up.
One of the things about in reading your book was about how politically active your family was to the point of going to the Freedom March and really getting to understand the teachings of Martin Luther King.
Right. And my mom especially. My mom was the secretary for the civil rights movement in our area. So for me, from the time I could remember, I was sitting next to her because it wasn't a babysitter at that time. I was sitting there in the meetings with her. And to see active live leadership at six, seven, 8 years old. And then when I was eight year old, I can remember coming in the house and Dr. King had just got assassinated. So to see the impact that had on my mom and my grandmom, and to see them cry like I'd never seen them cry before, I think that put an imprint on me as far as knowing how important his life was. And for me, to this day, I still continue to study what he brought to the table as far as the information that he left behind and the spirit in which he moved, and try to, you know, see if any way we can capture that in any way possible that I can use it to go forward and teach.
You know, for you, I mean, we bringing it back to basketball in Chicago Heights. I mean, that's when you learned that you could play the game.
No question.
And Jack, I know you and I talked offline just about, you know, what makes Craig Hodges, Craig Hodges is his shot. I mean, it's unbelievable how technical and how precise it is.
Yeah, and one of the things that interested me, and I think that will really interest Bulls fans, is that I don't know how many Bulls fans know that Tex Winter coached you in college.
Right.
And understand that association, that relationship goes well before you arrived in Chicago with the Bulls in 1989. And the way that he shaped you, and it sounds to me from reading the book that he shaped you both as a basketball player, teaching you the three F's, the foundation of shooting, and then as well as a man. What did you learn from a basketball standpoint that was most important from Tex, and what did you learn as a life standpoint important?
Going back to the question previous as far as shooting, and for me, I grew up shooting on Gavin school ground, and there wasn't a net And so when I think about shooting a basketball now and the quality of the way that I shot, I think about those days when I was shooting when it was twilight, when I couldn't shoot from the front because you couldn't really see the rim. So, and that's why I shot from the corner so well, because I shot from the corners all the way through life at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night when all I could see was the rim from the side. So I would shoot at that rim in the dark. So now when it was light, the corners were no issue. And going forward, when Tex recruited me when I was probably a junior in high school at Rich East, and like I told him then, man, I want to go somewhere warm, man. I'm tired of these winters. I don't know where that warm. I don't know what type of program it would be basketball wise. But UCLA at that time was the mainstay, and I was a John Wooden, you know, fanatic. So I wanted to go to UCLA growing up, and Tex. When my senior year, we had the City Suburban All-Star Game, and we played against the City, and I had a pretty good game, and Tex recruited me after that point, telling me, yeah, I just got the job at Long Beach, and I told him right there, and where do I sign? He's like, no, Craig, you got to take a visit. No, I don't, man. Just give me the paper before you sign somebody else.
That's great. So one really interesting part of the book where you're talking about what Tex taught you is the two-ball trick.
Right.
This idea that you shoot one ball at a time, but in reality, two fit in the rim.
No question at all.
At any one time.
Absolutely. And the critical part of it, Tex taught us, you know, two balls can fit in at one time, so you can never say that you're in a slump.
All right.
So you should be able to put one in and be able to try to put that one where those two coincide and intersect. So it was a lot of things that he taught me about shooting, and one of the things that he taught me was how important it is to get your arch out at the basket. When I was in high school, man, I shot 56% from the floor my senior year, and probably 75% were from 20 feet or more, but I was shooting a line drive, man. To this day, I don't know how I shot that percentage when I think about the trajectory of my shot and being able to work with Tex for 4 years and crystallize the importance of holding your follow-through and getting the ball out at the basket. Taught me a lot, man.
We'll talk about your time with Tex Winter, especially, you know, here in Chicago, coming up here after the break. The guest tonight at the big table, Craig Hodges, his book, Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. He's in studio tonight along with Jack Silverstein. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More Craig's story. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table is Craig Hodges, longtime great Chicago Bull. He's got a memoir out, Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. I'm joined by Jack Silverstein, the author of How the Goat Was Built, which is really about the 1996 team. Craig, you got a problem with that premise.
Well, you know, my premise is that in order to get all those other championships, we had to get that first one. And I think the struggles, similar to the struggles and triumphs of our team, because to go through the battles that we went through with Detroit, I think, gave us a certain wherewithal where I don't think anybody could have beat us, that team. So whether it was the teams after us or the teams before us, I think our mental toughness and approach to playing the game was such that when we got a lead, we weren't going to relinquish it. And we never were going to get behind out of the gates because MJ wasn't going to allow that.
Yeah.
And then our tenacity as a bench unit was such that we ain't going to let these guys get back in the game once they go out. So
it's interesting because you've had an NBA career much before you came to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Talk about that transition of playing, you know, being a kid who was at Long Beach State, mm-hmm. but, you know, being from Chicago Heights.
Right.
And playing on, were you on Milwaukee, you're on Phoenix, you're on other places before you came to Chicago.
Exactly, and I think that lent itself to when I got to Chicago, I was ready as a professional. I was ready to handle being at home, handle tickets, and handle saying no about, I ain't got no tickets, you know, and that type of stuff. Compared to younger in my career, I think it would have been a lot of distractions that I wouldn't have been able to handle and not have been as impactful a player as I was when I got here. But I think the Milwaukee experience gave me a certain realization of what it meant to be a professional.
How
playing under Don Nelson, playing with a superstar, Sidney Moncrief, Terry Cummins, Paul Pressey, guys who you know, really, Terry and I, we got traded into Milwaukee, and when we got there, we saw that it was a certain culture, and that culture involved mad work. And our defensive principles were such that no team was going to be in better condition than a Don Nelson team. And he was crazy at that point in his career compared to what he was when he got to the Warriors in our West and just let him play ball. Ours was more of a disciplined unit. And I respected that because when we went into games, we knew that we had shut down defense if we needed to stop.
What was the impact of you going against Jordan before you joined the team? Because obviously a lot of young guys who were on that team were drafted by the Bulls. All they knew was Jordan.
Right.
But you were used to going head-to-head with him, and you always talked about the ways in which you weren't afraid.
Right, and I think that was the Milwaukee teams because we played the Bulls in a couple playoffs and waxed them. So it wasn't a thing of being so much fear for the image or the majestic MJ, because he wasn't at that point in his career. He was still building that imagery. And I can recall one time we played them in Milwaukee, and we just happened to be going back from the layup lines at the same time, and we meet at half court and give each other dap. And I tell him at that point in time, I say, man, if we ever get together, we're going to win championships. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I was in Chicago, and we were on our way to winning championships.
What was your thought of before you came, when you said, you know, besides the fact of playing at home,
right?
What was your thought of those Bulls teams? What was your thought of coming to Doug Collins' run Chicago Bulls?
Well,
team?
It was, you know, and it was crazy because Jerry Colangelo grew up in Chicago Heights also. And when I was with Phoenix, the day that he traded me here, he brought me in. He was like, yeah, Hodge, we could use you as insurance guard just in case somebody goes down, but I got an opportunity for you to play somewhere right now. He's like, but I don't know if you want to go. I was like, what's up, Jay? He's like, Chicago wants you right now. You want to go play? I was like, come on, man. He was like, I know. Go ahead and go. But to me, it was just an understanding that Doug was very emotional, and he allowed, if you got on a run, Doug was going to let you roll. And that was the beautiful thing about it. If you made one shot, you got the next two trips down the court. So you could go on a roll where you could score 14, 16 points in a quarter. But that was fun. But it was still something missing. And I think when Phil got the job, he understood what he had over there in Tex. And he gave Tex an opportunity to do what he could do. And that's what I tell people about Phil, is his understanding of managing people and what their qualities are is a big reason of his success.
So one thing I'm interested in, and that I've been interested in for a little while, is this dichotomy in Phil Jackson between certain parts of his personality and other parts. Like, he exudes wisdom and compassion and mindfulness,
right.
The Zen master in the 60s and all that. Mm-hmm. And on the same time, he's been on the wrong side of history with black culture and hip-hop on a number of occasions.
No question.
We talk a lot about what does Michael Jordan need to do, and is he, you know, being responsible with his fame? But we don't really talk as much about that with Phil Jackson. Is that something that you ever struggled with, seeing him as a player and then as assistant coach?
And see, you understand it. For me, it's fun. It's fun to see, like you say, that dichotomy of you have endorsement deals that are bigger than a lot of pro athletes. So the Zen is without ego, but it's not without ego when we have those type of deals. So it's a balance, you know, and it's a game going on. It's a game to be played, man. And Phil understands how to play the game in order to do what he needs to do to get teams to play well, as far as when he was coaching, you know. But his struggles in New York, I think, stem from, you know, some organizational things that I had a chance to witness when I was with the D-League team. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think when you look at the cultural aspects, look where Phil came from. He's from, you know, a rural area where wasn't many black people around. So a lot of your upbringing is later in your life. Some of them come out not to be so palatable. So some of the things that he said about LeBron, I totally disagree with. I appreciate what he did for us winning championships, but at the same time, when you diss people on something that really shouldn't be handled that way, I can't agree with, man.
Is it? I mean, the story in the book is really about how the team came together, especially under Coach Jackson.
No question.
The mindfulness was what was missing.
Absolutely.
This concept of playing as a team.
Mm-hmm.
talk about your teammates.
I think, for real, you know, when I look at what really brought us together, it was the offense. And up until that point, everybody was standing watch MJ do his thing. And you might be in rhythm to catch the ball, you might be out of rhythm based on if he felt like giving it to you out of a double or triple team.
Right,
so
right,
it was based on you being able to read off him, where when the offense was installed in training camp, Scotty, MJ, Horace, they were all, man, this ain't going, oh, man, we ain't out, this triangle. Dude, I'm telling y'all.
And you knew it. You knew.
I'm telling them. By January, y'all going to love this. December 15th, man, this is the bomb, man, because 15 to 20% less energy has to be exerted for MJ in order to get the same amount of buckets. And everybody's able to get involved, and that's the biggest part of the system, I think. And even today, when I look at how many teams aren't trying to use it, that could use it and be like this team that I'm sitting in this city with right now, that's I don't know what they're
Why don't teams use it?
You can't use what you don't know.
Because it's such an intricate.
And it's not so much that it's so intricate. It's just a matter of every part of what you're doing goes into it. So if you're not coming out of the locker room in training camp doing it. So when I'm in New York watching Derek Fisher attempt to implement it, and I'm watching all of the wrong things going on, and I'm saying, and I'm watching Phil not really say anything because he's allowing Fish to do his thing, which I understand, but I'm telling Fish, dude, why are we cutting all these corners with the system? Because one thing about it, if you not implement it in the first 2 weeks, the NBA season is such where you can't go back and get this done.
Is the idea that cutting corners of the triangle has to do with the talent that's there? Some players don't want to play it that way?
That's why I say if you don't know it, you can't teach it. And there's a lot of things that it's not many, probably myself, Billy McKinney, maybe PJ, Phil Jackson. It's only like three of us that really have been taught it from the master, Tex. And for me, when I look at it, it's the most simplistic thing going because it teaches ball movement, player movement, and spacing. Mm-hmm. Everything that's composed in winning championships. So if you look across the landscape of the last couple champions that have won it, and you look at parts of the system that they use, Golden State, dribble weave, San Antonio, dribble weave, Golden State drawing kicks, all of that's triangle. All of that is triangle.
They're just taking little parts.
Taking little parts, and that's the whole thing with the NBA. That was one of the first lessons I learned is that if something worked against you in a game, you stole it and used it the next game against the next team. So it's all about stealing somebody else's stuff that works.
Right, and the triangle is so simple, seemingly, and yet it has become something that people think they can't handle.
Right, and it's all based upon knowing that you got a strong side and a weak side. Three people on one side, two people on the other, and how do you get them there as undercover as possible and as with the least amount of pressure, so we never fought pressure.
Are we talking about basketball or life here?
Both.
Okay, good. The triangle works for both, right?
No question.
Greg Hodges is my guest. He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. Jack Silverstein's also in studio tonight. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and let's talk a little bit more about politics and your worldview.
No question.
And we'll go from there. Craig Hodges, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. Thanks, Veronica. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Craig Hodges, the great sharpshooter for the Chicago Bulls. Man, I would always, in the neighborhood back in Wonder Lake, I'm Craig Hodges.
I hear you, man.
You be John Paxson. I'll be Craig Hodges.
I appreciate that, man. That's something.
He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. Jack Silverstein's also in studio. He's our unofficial statistician and Bulls historian. Here on the download, also the author of How the GOAT Was Built, the story of the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's get back to basketball. Mm-hmm. But you know, when we talk with you, Craig, the book is half about basketball and all the great stories behind the scenes of the Chicago Bulls and building a championship. Mm-hmm. But it's also about politics. And it's also about your story of finding a way to use your platform to be able to speak to the issues of the time.
Mm-hmm. And when we were off air, you was talking about the intro to politics and sport on the NBA level. Bill Walton, who I love dearly, who was my mentor in as far as understanding the politics of professional sports, first thing he taught me, he's like, I'm going to make you play a rep because you need to understand what's happening. I was like, yeah, okay, man, I do it because I'm a rookie. I do anything. Just make sure I'm here. So he said, the thing that you always have to remember is that players are separate from management.
Right.
And always remember, as a player, that you go down with the players and you stay with the players. And I think, for me, that has never changed. Even when I was with the Lakers and player development, I would always make sure that I told Phil, I don't want to be in any meetings when a player is getting ready to get cut, because I don't want to have to go out and work with somebody and then you're going to come out and tell him he has to go after we're working on things to get somebody better. And I think that's the part, for me, it gave me a choice.
You know, you talk about it because early on in your career when you're playing for the Clippers,
right?
You know, you got your first check and you're so excited. Mm-hmm.
And then, no signature.
And there's no signature on the check. Right. And then you check it in and the owner.
That is a savage Donald Sterling.
Right. But and that's the thing, when you look at those franchises, and it is like any other business where you have those businesses that are quality within the framework of whether it's accounting or law or lawyering or whatever you're saying. But it's the thing where the quality of organization from when I was with the Clippers to the Milwaukee Bucks was night and day, you know, and you have different, you know, different feelings and different spiritual parts of organizations that come through. And I think, to me, the greatest organization that I've had a part to play in, I think, is Los Angeles Lakers, I'd have to say. You know, just the quality of, just the quality of care, I'm going to say, that they have respect for, realizing that the players matter, and we're going to do a lot to make sure and ensure that the players are ready to play.
Well, let me ask you, Craig, it's a nice transition into the fact that there's a lot to be said about how free agents don't want to come to Chicago, and the Chicago Bulls organization is not player friendly.
Right.
I mean, tell us, I mean, where do the Bulls rank when it comes to the cultures and the organization?
I think now it's kind of low, man. And it's sad, you know, at one point I think we're a destination city. You know, we're still a destination city from the standpoint of what we have to offer. But I think from a basketball end, it has something to be said when you look at players who don't really want to come here and play. And to be in a town like this where you have a media market, you have, you know, instant credibility if you do what you're capable of doing on the court. So it's odd. But at the same time, when you're not winning, man, and when you don't have a winning attitude to lead out. And I think, you know, to some degree, when Derrick Rose left, some of the spirit left. And when we talk about the spirit, I think Chicago has a lot to offer, especially when I look at fan base and fan support. If you come in and play hard, man, the fans will support you. But if you go out there and you lacking, the city is going, they're not going to, you know, really come and support you. And mainly, you know, you're going to get your 19,000 or whatever you get at the United Center. But that's corporate. That's not really grassroots.
Jack and I, when we were getting ready to talk to you, I mean, one of the things that we think about today is Derrick Rose gets on the court and he wears an I Can't Breathe t-shirt, or Joakim Noah talks about issues, you know, that are not on the basketball. And he's met with a little bit of criticism in Chicago.
Right.
Let's go back to your career.
Right.
You know, predating those guys. Mm-hmm. Talk about when the Bulls were making a run to the championship. And Jack, specifically, you know, you were leading up trying to get the attention of Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant.
Yeah, so this is one of the most striking sections of the book, at least to me. Let me set the stage for listeners. 1991, game one, NBA Finals, Chicago Stadium. It's the Bulls' first championship series.
Absolutely.
It's against the Los Angeles Lakers. You approach the game's two biggest stars, not just in the series, but in the NBA at that point.
Absolutely.
Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, you approach them with a request. What did you ask them?
I felt that was the only time that we have power, is at All-Star weekend and playoff time. And taking from an example of Jerry West and Elgin Baylor in the 1963 All-Star game, when they called for a work stoppage, I felt that this was a great time for us to call for a work stoppage. And as far as we were trying to get minorities in upper management and on the executive level of the game, and I felt that at that time, 21 of the 24 athletes were black, that if we stood up And say we didn't come out for the first 19, when the clock turned on 19, people would be like, well, they're playing psychological games. 16 minutes, what's going on? 15 minutes, the commissioner would have, Commissioner Stern would have came out and said, what's going on? And I think we don't realize the impact that we have at certain parts and at certain points in our careers, and that we think in terms that, well, I can go ahead and make this bread and I'll come back and visit that issue later.
Later, right?
When you come back to visit the issue later, you don't have the platform
anymore. What did Michael Jordan say?
It's too extreme. He and Magic both. And I can understand when you haven't studied it, so I couldn't.
Haven't studied politics.
You haven't studied. You haven't studied the impact of what your career and what you bring to the table. So I liken it to Paul Robeson. I liken it to, you know, Harry Belafonte and all of the
people who stood up,
people who were in the movement, who not only stood but stood and put their money forth and to help. And if you're capable of doing that, that's fine. But we need sweat equity also. So whatever you can bring to the table, bring that. And that was my position. It's not anything to me any extreme from anybody else that wants to further the condition of their people to get us in a better state, man.
You talk a lot in the book about trying to pull the young bulls aside and mm-hmm. talk about mm-hmm. not only political mm-hmm. times but Black history.
Right, right.
What was their reaction? What was a Michael Jordan? And he doesn't seem, and we've known mm-hmm. him for, you know, mm-hmm. as right, media as right. fans, has to be apolitical as somebody who's right. just a celebrity. And he talk about your
and
relationship.
And that's the beautiful part is that I was blessed to be on the bus, to be in the locker room, to be in the training room when the real conversations are going on, and that no one's in a vacuum, man. No, this stuff is affecting everybody. Now, the manner in which it affects you is dependent on where you're from. Me, personally, I grew up in the Heights. I grew up from here. So my perspective was I want my city to do better. And me being a champion here, I can do as much as I can to lift us up. And I think many times when, you know, they would hear me, we would talk, we'd have great conversations. I would give them literature. They would take it, accept it, read it, tell me how cool it is. But to actually go out and let it manifest in what you're doing is something different. And the money has so much of an impact on whether people say anything or not, man. And we can try to play it off, but we know that if certain things are said and they're not palatable, then you can pay a heavy price.
Well, it was a tumultuous time, too.
No
I mean,
question.
The early 90s, you had the first Gulf War.
Yes.
You had Rodney King.
Yes.
You had the Nike boycott.
No
this
question.
Idea of Nike taking advantage or, you know, at least exploiting young Black youth when you know, talking about shoe sales mm-hmm. and no Black people mm-hmm. were actually working in the company. Mm-hmm.
And so, I know that Phil was very outspoken about those issues in the
right,
locker room, about
right.
asking you guys,
right.
how do you feel about this, you know,
exactly.
about these war efforts? How
exactly.
do you feel about right?
In fact, when the Gulf War jumped off, we were in Orlando, if I recall. And he called us in the huddle, right? Because they said it during right after the national anthem. They said that we're at war. President Bush declared war against Iraq. And a lot of guys came back to the huddle. Man, let's bomb them off the map. Let's all of this kind of stuff. And Phil said, and I quote, that 20 years from now, you're going to have to worry about that same family who got blew off the map, who had a baby that was still alive that came over here and they're sitting in a movie theater with a bomb strapped to them. And some of those things came to fruit. But you know, it's one of those things that was a time during that period of time, man, there were so many political issues going on, but we didn't have the luxury of social media. And had that been the case, different story, man.
We're talking with Craig Hodges mm-hmm. here on The Download. He's got a new book. Jack Silverstein joined us as well. Let's take our last break here,
okay.
and we'll come back. And
sure.
I want to talk about your final days with the Chicago Bulls mm-hmm. and what happened subsequent to the Bulls and the end of your playing career.
Got you.
Craig Hodges,
cool.
my guest. He's the author of Long Shot, Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, in studio with me, Craig Hodges. He's the author of Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter, good old number 14. Jack Silverstein's also here. And we're running out of time, and there's so much to talk about. This book is great.
Thanks, man.
You know, it's interesting because the first time I think that NBA fans, mm-hmm. at least Chicago Bulls fans, were aware of your politics was the visit to the White House with George H.W. Bush. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. You wore the dashiki. Talk about what you went to the White House, what you wanted to
do. Well, the biggest thing was I had been wearing dashikis for the previous season. So the whole playoff, I wore a dashiki, so it wasn't an issue. In fact, you know, we're ritualistic as players, so everybody asking, Hodge, you got another dashiki? Yo, man, we good to go. We good to go for the whole shebang. But for me, it was just a matter and a cultural imperative that I had been a, you know, a descendant of slaves, and part of my family's Native American, so we've been blessed to be here. And for me, it was just a culmination of being able to thank my ancestors and all those freedom fighters who had given me an opportunity to be able to be even be here, and then to be able to write the president a letter and go in total respect. I was not disrespectful. I didn't thumb my nose at him and say, nah, man, I ain't going to the White House. But I went as a matter of respect and out of respect to my ancestors and what they blessed me to study, and then to be able to say thank you and let the president know that I'm coming on behalf of people who wouldn't get a chance to come to the White House, and would you consider their issues the same way you consider foreign policy.
Yeah. And what's, I think, doubly interesting about mm-hmm. that happening, that you showed up with a letter mm-hmm. and people said, oh, this is so controversial.
Right.
Michael Jordan didn't show up at all.
Right. Or PAX.
Or PAX. Okay. Right. Well, Mike was in South Carolina playing golf.
Right.
So which is the bigger affront to the presidency? Is it showing up with a letter asking for rights, or is it going to golf?
Right. And the biggest thing, too, is that when we look at the economic impact of Craig Hodges doing what I did was only impactful to me, you know, and my family. If it came out that way towards MJ, you look at all those different corporations that would have to maybe pull the plug on his endorsement. That wasn't going to happen, man. So I don't look at it like that.
You know, fast forward to the Portland Trailblazers series, and you know, a lot of media around the mm-hmm. Chicago Bulls. Mm-hmm. And the New York Times talked to you and asked questions about civil rights issues, mm-hmm. Issues that were happening.
Right.
And you spoke frankly, and you even talked about, you know, you wanted Michael Jordan to be more
all of us. And you know, we do a lot of stuff through foundations, through 501c3s, through organizations that keep us anonymous, and that's cool. That's cool. But at the same time, when our condition is what it is, people need to see that we care and that we give a damn. And I think one of the biggest ways to show that is to have a part in this thing, man.
But in this article, and you know, this was during mm-hmm. the NBA finals.
That's right.
The New York Times. Mm-hmm. pulled out the quote that you had something to say about Michael Jordan.
Right.
How did Michael Jordan respond?
And see, that's the wild part, is that MJ would come to me after stuff like that and be like, hi, did you see this garbage? I was like, brother, I see it. I'm not sweating it. You know me. And I tell him, man, we need help. It's not a matter of nothing that came out in any of them articles was any surprise to him, because everything that we're saying now, he's heard of it before.
Right.
And so from that's the biggest thing with our culture right now is, in rap, we have beef, and everybody got to have a beef in order to sell something. And in that beef is the destruction of my community. So I'm not going to allow anybody to start a beef between me and my brother over this stuff that we ain't got no impact on. Because when I look at the bottom line of Brand Jordan or Nike or anybody else, the bottom line is we are consumers in that. And our consumer dollars plays an important impact in that. In that, if we can harness our consumer dollar, then I think we can change the condition on the streets.
Well, you know, after that article came out, mm-hmm. was the final game of the NBA Finals, whatever.
Right, right, absolutely.
And you didn't play much.
Perfectly timed.
Perfectly timed. you didn't play much in that game. As a matter of fact, that's a mm-hmm. game Chicago Bulls fans remember. Another reserve guard and Bobby Hanson.
Bobby Hanson. Absolutely.
Yeah. In
absolutely.
That game.
No question.
Another championship
and
for the Bulls.
And I love Bobby, too. Yeah. That's my boy.
That summer, Jerry Krause gives you a call, says, you know what, mm-hmm. we're moving in a different direction.
Absolutely.
We're going younger. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
You tell me that you thank me for keeping an eye on the young guys, BJ, Hora, Scotty, which I said, I'm not a babysitter, I'm a hooper, but that's another part of the story. And then he says, yeah, we're going to go younger. Then a week and a half later, you hire Trent Tucker, who happens to be probably 4 or 5 months older than Hodge. So, it, you know, to me, it's just a, when I look at it, I'm so happy that I'm blessed to be able to look at it in the spirit that I can.
Why not move on to another team?
Well, it's like everything else, man. At that point in time, would nobody touch me? And, you know, Dave Zirin, who wrote the foreword for my book, enlightened me to how many players that he talked to who said they didn't want to be like Hodge. And as far as standing up and that it could possibly hurt your chance to play any further, and especially the finances that are happening now in the league, man, I can understand why somebody wouldn't stand up. You know, I wouldn't hold it against them. But at the same time, I would tell them that in this social media, you should be able to have a safety net of people who support you to be able to show that, hey, man, you're doing the right thing.
You know, Jack, and you've got a story, too, about the Chicago Bulls players. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of players knew exactly what happened to
no
you.
No question.
They knew that this mm-hmm. was more about something else besides mm-hmm. off the court than what was on the basketball.
Absolutely.
How did they react? I mean, have you kept relationships with
these
guys?
You know, and it's cool because as we get older, we get wiser. And a lot of young guys that, you know, Scotty, Horace, BJ, they've come to me. You know, I had a chance to sit down with Horace after the TNT and as well as speak to BJ Armstrong, and they told me how much an impact I've had in as far as what they've studied the last couple of years, and that the stuff that I was studying in 91, they're picking up now. So it's cool to know that, you know, consciousness comes, and to sit down, to have a chance to sit down at dinner with Horace and his son and him to tell me that he felt that he could have had my back a little bit better. And I told him, man, we were all young at that time, and I was just blessed to have studied something that y'all didn't study. So, you know, thanks for it, and I appreciate the dinner.
And you guys sat for 3 hours. Do you see a relationship now moving forward?
Yeah, we've always had a cool relationship, Horace and I. We were always Jordanaires. So, and we took those roles to be funny, but at the same time, we were serious about making sure that our team was the best team. And, you know, irregardless to what went on as far as, you know, him not getting the ball and MJ not giving him the ball when he wants it, he knew that the role that he played was as important as my role, as important as Will Perdue. So we understood that everybody played a significant role in us winning, and we didn't negate anybody's role in that. And I think my politics and my mindset was just something that helped during those road trips when they were on the plane. Yo, Hodge, what you think about this? And we'd have a conversation that got us to our next airport. So I think all of those stories come together, and it's part of life and life experience.
As we wrap up, real mm-hmm. quick, the mm-hmm. last thing I'd want to ask Craig
yes,
Hodges.
Yes.
Do you recognize you still in your head? I mean, for mm-hmm. everything that happened to mm-hmm. you, and you're blacklisted, mm-hmm. you didn't play again, you mm-hmm. were unceremoniously dropped by the Bulls.
Right.
Do you still feel the love from Chicago Bulls fans?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the beautiful part of it, man, is that I can be in the city and be somewhere and people is like, man, I just want to thank you for what you did, for winning championships and the joy that you gave me and my wife, or the joy that you gave my grandmom, who was a staunch Bull fan. I tell Bulls fans all the time is that, you know, there was never a point when I played here that I didn't feel like I was carrying the whole city into the game behind me. So I knew they had my back, and I knew that they were going to cheer for me. And off the court, it was like, during the time when we was winning, man, our money wouldn't spend in the city, so it was a great thing.
Well, it's a great book. Check it out. Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. The book is, of course, written by Craig Hodges.
Thank you.
Craig, thanks for being here. Jack
Appreciate
as well. Jack Silverstein, who has written the book, How the GOAT Was Built, Story of the 1996 Bulls.
Cool.
Second best.
Yes. Right. Yeah. I ain't going to hold it against him, though, man. He's a fellow writer.
Thanks, guys.
God bless and peace to all your listeners, man.